You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
You're listening to the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. During his party conference speech this month, David Cameron promised, "When it comes to free movement, I will get what Britain needs." Tory backbenchers have been told to expect a game-changing announcement on immigration almost certainly before Christmas. There's plenty of speculation about how EU migration might be curbed. A national insurance scheme to limit the number of low-skilled workers, maybe. Perhaps a points-based system. But today's message from the President of the EU Commission, José Manuel Barroso, was, "Ponder all you want. In reality, any attempt to place an arbitrary cap on EU migration or tamper with the principle of free movement would be in contradiction of EU rules." The standoff comes at the start of a week in which MPs will discuss the recall bill and the future of the welfare minister, Lord Freud. James Chapman, the political editor of the Daily Mail, joined me earlier for a look ahead. What was he hearing about the contents of the Prime Minister's much-anticipated migration speech?
I'm not sure Number 10 are absolutely certain yet what the content of it's going to be. And there's a sense, actually, that they are rather letting speculation about it run out of control. It reminds me a bit of the build-up to his speech on the EU referendum, which, if you remember, there was speculation about for months beforehand, before he finally made that referendum pledge. So there's talk about some sort of emergency brake on EU migration that could be applied when numbers of incomers, you know, were significantly ahead of forecasts. There's talk of limiting availability of tax credits to EU migrants, and there's some talk about national insurance numbers as well. But we are hearing it's going to be sooner rather than later.
Before the Rochester and Stroud by-election?
They've not decided on that yet. We've been told it will be before Christmas. Oh. I think the dilemma in Number 10 is, would it look a bit opportunistic or a bit desperate, a bit panicked, really, to come out with all this before the Rochester by-election on November the 20th? At the same time, though, I think there's also a sense there that they are allowing expectations to build up to probably an unfeasible point.
And whatever they're thinking, today the President of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, said any sort of cap would be in breach of EU rules.
He did, actually. I think in some senses José Manuel Barroso, who's giving a big speech in London tomorrow, is kind of trying to be helpful, but he's actually pointing out that under the existing rules you couldn't have any such arrangement. We're hearing that he's going to talk in quite strong terms tomorrow about the frustration there is in Brussels about the lack of people, as they see it, speaking up for Britain's membership of the European Union in Britain. He's talking about how he believes Britain would be marginalised in terms of world affairs if it did leave the EU. And he's criticising David Cameron's, as he calls it, defensive strategy on EU membership. If he keeps attacking the EU, how does he hope to persuade people to stay in the EU when it comes to that referendum?
But when it comes to it, what chance is there of Europe complying with the sorts of demands that David Cameron's going to make in these negotiations?
Well, I think there is some support, actually, more than you might expect, particularly in Germany, for this emergency brake idea. So I think there is some support for that, actually. In the Foreign Office, I think the mood music from around Angela Merkel in particular is quite positive. But I do think, when you start to talk about access to national insurance numbers or tax credits, I don't see how the rest of the European Union is going to allow Britain to effectively discriminate against people from Europe.
And while this prospect of change is being held up, do you think it's going to make any difference to the way that people might vote in that Rochester and Stroud by-election on November the 20th? Or will those who are thinking of voting UKIP still vote UKIP?
I'm not sure it will do a great deal of good. I mean, UKIP's position is to withdraw from the EU and pull up the drawbridge, and David Cameron is not going to compete with that. And I think there is some concern in the Cabinet, across the backbenches as well, actually, that voters are not likely to be swayed by talk of national insurance numbers or European arrest warrants, however much people at Westminster are obsessed with those issues. And there's some frustration that since the conference speech, David Cameron's very successful conference speech, which he talked about tax cuts, and the Tories went ahead in the polls for a period, we've heard nothing on that subject since then. And I think there is some concern in the Tory party that it's looking a bit obsessed with Europe. They're not sure it's going to really sway the result of the Rochester by-election, and they would quite like David Cameron to get back to talking about the economy.
If the Conservatives lose in Rochester, how much of a threat would that pose for David Cameron? There's always talk, isn't there, of a leadership challenge and people getting signatures together to put to the chairman of the 1922 committee. Could it really get that serious?
I think the Tory party will have something of a nervous breakdown if it loses Rochester. The Clacton result was kind of priced in. I think they accepted they were going to lose there. I think to lose two by-elections in succession, you would see some letters going in. It's possible you'd get to the 46 necessary to trigger a leadership challenge, which David Cameron would win. There isn't an obvious replacement for David Cameron. Boris Johnson's not in Parliament. So there isn't somebody waiting in the wings that the plotters could turn to. So I don't think it will get to that point. But I think that David Cameron will have a very difficult period. And the great concern, of course, is that a win for Mark Reckless in a seat like Rochester, which is very different, much more middle class than Clacton, not an obvious UKIP target. The concern is that might trigger more defections from the Tory backbenches to UKIP.
With the general election date creeping ever closer, whoever wins that will be faced with the fait accompli of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, meaning that there won't be another election for another 5 years. There's going to be a debate about that on Thursday. Some people really want to get rid of this act, don't they?
That's right. The Tory backbenchers are waking up to what this Fixed Term Parliaments Act passed very early on in the coalition actually means. This was a big constitutional change put together in quite a hurry in order to essentially get the coalition, stick it together, ensure that one party couldn't walk out, but it's going to have huge impact. And this debate on Thursday, I think we're going to hear quite a strong demand from the Tory backbenchers to repeal this act. And the concern is that it means that a Prime Minister who wanted to lead a minority government would not have the power to call an election when he or she wanted to. You need a two-thirds supermajority in the Commons in order to trigger an election outside the five-year fixed timetable.
At the end of the week, we'll have the latest economic growth figures out. They're expected to contain more good news, but Labour, we know, want to focus a lot on the NHS, so they may want to talk more about that. Is that because Ed Miliband feels that Labour will always be trusted more on health than the other parties?
I think it was clear at their conference that he wants to put health at the centre of his election campaign. Andy Burnham's been out today talking about cancer pledges, pledges around cancer waiting times and that sort of thing. I think the risk for Labour is that this focus on the NHS will make people look at what's going on in the one area of the country where they're actually running the health service, which is Wales. My newspaper has been looking at that actually for some time, and we're running an investigation into care in Wales. There's evidence people are crossing the border into England to get treatment. There's strong calls for an independent inquiry to look at what's going on in Wales.
What about other issues for Labour? I mean, they've got some brewing problems as well in Scotland, haven't they?
There is what looks like a real potential crisis for Labour in Scotland, and the latest polls have been very grim. It looks like the Labour voters who were not persuaded to vote no in the independence referendum, they seem to have stuck with the SNP. There's a bleak mood around about the future of the Labour leader in Scotland, Johan Lamont. Jim Murphy, who'd been tipped as a sort of Blairite successor to her, has ruled himself out. There's lots of talk about whether Gordon Brown can be persuaded to come back and lead Labour in Scotland. But at the moment, we've got the pollsters. Peter Kellner of YouGov, for example, is talking about Labour potentially losing 20 seats in Scotland to the SNP, which would be an extraordinary blow to Ed Miliband's hopes of getting a majority.
James Chapman, well, listening to that here with me in the studio, is the Conservative MP Mark Garnier. And on the line from their constituencies, Labour's Lisa Nandy and the Liberal Democrat Andrew George. Welcome, all of you. And Andrew, I just wanted to start with you, actually. Just one question about Ebola, because you're on the Health Select Committee, aren't you? And, of course, these global worries about the scale of Ebola continue. You're going to be hearing from senior NHS officials on Wednesday, isn't it? What are you going to be asking them?
Well, obviously the Health Select Committee looks at the United Kingdom's health system primarily, and so we'll be looking at the level of preparation, training, procedures, whether we've got the tools in place, and how to protect our frontline, if you like, defence, which is of course the health workers themselves. I mean, if the advice doesn't go out to the general public and those with potential infections rush into A&E departments infecting everyone, including health workers, in an ill-coordinated way, that's clearly not going to add to the best environment for effective infection control. So there'll be a whole range of questions, and I think lessons to be learnt from how, for example, Nigeria have very successfully managed to handle the situation there, in contrast to other countries.
Well, that's Wednesday. You'll be hearing from those officials. Let's look to the issue of the day and the issue of migration from the EU. No sooner had stories appeared in the papers today about a possible national insurance cap plan to reduce immigration from Europe than up pops the European Commission President José Manuel Barroso to say that arbitrary caps of this kind would be contrary to EU law. Mark, you're a member of the Fresh Start group, aren't you? That's a group trying to redraw legislation, if you like, to give power back to the UK. But Mr. Barroso's right, isn't he? As long as EU law is there, these arbitrary caps won't be allowed.
Well, it's way above my pay grade to start looking at the sort of the minutiae of the legal side of Europe. But I suspect if he's going to say that, he's probably right. And I think it's very important that we do try and kind of assess what the legal position is. But the other side of this argument was also made by him.
I think it's the Treaty of Rome, isn't it? It's free movement under the Treaty of Rome. You'd have to change that.
It is absolutely right. And, of course, we do have quite a large British diaspora within Europe itself. And how's that going to be affected? If we then have a barrier to any more EU migrants coming into the UK, then, of course, they could easily turn around and say, we don't want any more of your pensioners coming and retiring to the Algarve. But the biggest problem we have in this country is we're a victim of our own success. We have such an enormous pull factor here in the UK because we have the strongest economy in Europe. We have created more jobs in Europe, more jobs in the UK than the rest of Europe put together. And we now have the added problem coming up, which is that Europe now looks as if it's going to hit its triple dip recession. Mm. So if we see economic problems in Europe, then the migration pull factor, if you like, to the UK is going to be even greater.
But the fact that UKIP have been able to capitalise on real concerns about the numbers of EU migrants. So with next month's battle against UKIP in the Rochester and Stroud by-election in mind, do you think that David Cameron should be ready to campaign for an exit from the EU if he fails to get what he wants in terms of curbing EU migration?
Well, the one thing I know about David Cameron is he is not a what-if politician. So he's not the sort of person who would turn around and say, well, you know, if we don't get this or if we do get that, then
even if his backbenchers are crying out for reassurance, as many of them are.
Well, speaking as a backbencher on the Fresh Start project, and I'm probably more on the pro-European side of the Fresh Start project than the anti-European side, what I would wait for is a proper full and frank debate about this. And I think the Scottish referendum has shown us very clearly that actually when you do have a referendum on quite a big constitutional issue, you do get a huge number of very, very important factors which are being debated and properly aired. And I think that this is one of the reasons why whatever happens, we've got to have a proper debate. We've got to have a look at the proper arguments. We've got to understand, you know, what coming out of Europe means. And Nigel Farage has said himself that coming out of Europe would mean a 2 percentage point cut in the growth rate of our economy.
And Mr. Barroso said Britain will have zero influence if it leaves the EU. Let me bring in Lisa here. Do you think, Lisa, that there should be some sorts of quotas? Because, I mean, I've spoken to you many times on this programme and you've said, haven't you, that young people in this country have struggled to compete for jobs with migrants from countries in Eastern Europe who've joined the EU. There have been concerns expressed, haven't there, in by-elections like Hayward and Middleton about the scale of EU migration?
I mean, I think we've got a huge and separate problem with youth unemployment in this country, but I think it's not entirely clear what sort of problems David Cameron is trying to deal with. I mean, we've had these announcements this morning. They're not actually announcements. They're sort of vague promises made by anonymous Conservative briefings, and we haven't got any detail on it. But the trouble is that every time that he shifts his position in response either to his own backbenchers or to UKIP, we become more isolated in Europe. And if you believe, as I do, that Europe has been extremely good for many of my constituents, it's helped to support a lot of our small and medium-sized businesses who are the major employer with trade and with jobs. It's helped to provide labour market protections for people that have actually kept some of my constituents alive through health and safety laws. If you believe that it's important that we're at the heart of Europe with maximum influence, then every time we have an announcement like this and then a fresh response from Europe that says, hang on a minute, what do you mean? We become more isolated.
So does this mean that you're in agreement with Diane Abbott, your colleague, who's today accused some Labour MPs of hysteria and trying to out UKIP, if you like? She accused some Labour MPs of repeating things about immigration which aren't true. And we've certainly had Labour MPs on this programme like Tom Harris and John Mann who've complained about the free movement of Labour in the EU and the impact it's had on their constituents. Do you think that's the sort of example of hysteria in your view?
I mean, you know, go back to the point that it's not entirely clear every time Cameron changes his position what problem he's trying to tackle. And actually, I would say that one of the problems we've got at the moment is that we've got free movement, but we haven't necessarily got fair movement. So we've got a situation, for example, in constituencies like mine, where employers, some not many, but a minority of unscrupulous employers are able to undercut wages by exploiting migrants in the construction industry and other industries too. Now, one of the ways to deal with that is to make sure that you enforce the minimum wage and put money into that.
And
but
we have heard Labour proposals on that. I just wonder whether you think that there should be a clampdown on migration. I mean, all the parties agree, you know, on the benefits movements and clamping down on that. But it's really this idea of whether you put a limit on EU migration.
Well, I was just about to say that one of the huge issues, of course, is that many of those immigrants who are coming to the UK trying to make a better life, trying to do a decent job, who are then exploited by unscrupulous employers, aren't even here legally. So one of the problems with the way that Cameron's been dealing with the European issue and the immigration issue is that at the same time they've made huge cuts to the UK border force, and that agency has been plunged into chaos, and so isn't actually dealing with the real problems that we've got. And you know, in the meantime, you've got immigrants who are being exploited, and you've got people in Britain whose wages are being undercut. And we could tackle that if we chose to, but we're not.
Let me bring Andrew in. Free movement, not fair movement. Is that possible?
Well, I mean, I think as Lisa was saying, you know, what is the problem that Cameron is dealing with? I think it's political rather than immigration is the problem that he seems to have. I mean, as many Britons are living and indeed working in the EU, as we have EU citizens living and working here, and as Mark indicated, really, we need to be careful that we don't end up with a backlash against Britons living and working, you know, legally abroad. And the problem which I think we have is that whilst I can understand that there are political and presentational problems for the Conservatives at the moment, we need to be careful and responsible to make sure that any proposals are plausible. I mean, what the coalition originally agreed was something which the Liberal Democrats insisted on, is that we introduce effective border checks and controls to exactly deal with the kind of illegal immigration which Lisa has just
Lisa
described.
Was calling for,
exactly.
Just briefly, though, I mean, you know, there is this growing concern, though, isn't there? And you must all acknowledge it, that UKIP are able to say we will pull out of the European Union and you won't face this problem. So, you know, talking about improving borders and talking about enthusiasm for Europe is not going to win over those people who are going to vote for UKIP, is it, Mark?
No, it's not. And I think the immigration problem or the immigration debate that comes up on the doorstep time and again whenever we're knocking on doors is probably masking something which is far more fundamentally you know, a much deeper problem with the electorate and how they view politicians. Nigel Farage has the quick answer to what are very, very profound and very complex problems. And actually all three of our parties are failing to engage properly with the electorate.
But Caroline, could I just question this idea that by making the positive case for Europe, we're not helping to address people's concerns? Because actually, I think this is one of the problems with UKIP, as Mark was just saying. They offer very, very simple problems to very solutions to very complex questions. And actually, by making the case for some of the things that Europe has done for people in constituencies like mine in Wigan, I think we help to open up this debate and rebalance this debate again. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of my constituents still go off to war when we're at war in this country. You know, we've had decades of peace because of our cooperation with Europe, and that's something that really does matter to my constituents, but we don't hear it in the public debate very often.
We will be debating it a lot more in future. Let me choose look at Tuesday, the recall bill. It's the second reading of the recall of MPs bill, proposing that MPs could automatically face a by-election if jailed or if suspended from the House to 21 sitting days. Lisa, Zach Goldsmith wants to change it, to toughen this bill, to make the sole criteria for triggering a recall by-election a petition signed by 20% of voters in a constituency. Yeah. He wants to rewrite the bill with Labour support. Do you support him?
Well, we're going to be giving the bill a second reading on Tuesday because we've waited 4 years for this piece of legislation, and although it's not good enough as it is, we certainly support recall very strongly in principle, and we want to see it improved rather than ditched. I think where the government is and the proposals that they've put forward are problematic because they place the majority of power in the hands of MPs and not the public. And
yes, it's because it has to be approved by a committee before it goes forward.
That's right.
But just briefly then, would you support going further and endorsing this idea of 20% of voters in a particular constituency being able to call for an MP to go?
I mean, we think there's a lot of merit in what Zach Goldsmith's proposing, but there are some safeguards that I think have to be built in to make sure that big money interests can't target members of Parliament who voice unpopular views or take them on. Just to give you a very quick example, Chris Mullin, the Labour MP who campaigned for years for the Birmingham Six at a time when that was deeply, deeply unpopular. We'd hate to see those dissenting voices being silenced in politics at a time when we probably need more of them, not less.
And Andrew, you agree with that. I mean, you have concerns about if MPs have decided to stand up for a cause some constituents disagree with or regard as unpopular. You've got personal experience, haven't you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I chair the all-party parliamentary Gypsy Roman Traveller group. You know, if you stand up for minorities, particularly those who are considered to be the last bastion of acceptable prejudice, I mean, you know, the way that Zach Goldsmith words it, indeed, in one of his parliamentary motions, is that you can call a by-election for, and I quote, whatever reason. Well, if you have a situation where you have whatever reason, well, of course, it can be, you know, the cut of your jib or anything. I mean, and if you end up with a political tool which opponents can use, particularly in marginal seats where you have campaigning MPs who actually stand up for minorities or stand up for gay rights or whatever it happens to be, you can imagine in those circumstances that political opponents either in name or more likely covertly will be using their influence and their money to try and destabilise that MP, and that will actually discourage those kind of dissenting and rebellious and outspoken voices, which is exactly what Parliament needs.
Mark?
Well, I think we're looking at sort of unpopular MPs, but what about unpopular secretaries of state trying to bring through big bills? And I was looking back on the great campaign against Andrew Lansley when he was bringing through the health bill 2 or 3 years ago. You could find in the modern day of the internet technology and campaigns, and you know, I'm not suggesting 38 Degrees would necessarily organise this, but another group could set up that could organise a campaign very, very effectively against an individual Secretary of State, and you would end up with very, very weak government as a result of this.
Well, we'll see what happens with the bill. Andrew, you mentioned MPs not being able to say what they really think. Lord Freud, his remarks were taped apparently by a Labour researcher and used by Ed Miliband to raise the question in PMQs this week. Does that mean that politicians just have to get used now to being on display and on parade all the time, wherever they are?
Well, of course they do. You know, it's 24-hour media and 24-hour social comment and 24-hour trolling. You know, MPs and indeed in the case of Lord Freud, their lordships, do have to get used to this. But whether his comments, in which he said they are disabled people, that is not worth the full wage, whether that was simply clumsy or whether there was something more sinister underlying it, I think was in part largely answered by Lord Freud himself when he apologised for those comments. And certainly we need to be extremely careful. I mean, I mean I've got a speech impediment, so often I speak rather clumsily, and you always worry that if something comes out wrongly, that of course you can be hung by that, and no matter how much you try to put it right afterwards, it'll always live with you.
I've just got 2 minutes left, so one to you, Lisa. You still want him to go, don't you, even though there's been a bit of a backlash against Labour for raising this issue?
Well, I mean, even if you accept that somebody misspeaking and ends up with them saying that people aren't worth the minimum wage, you know, even if you accept that, there is a real problem here with what he said, which was to contemplate the idea that solving the problem we've got of disabled people not being able to get equal access to employment in this country, the way to solve that is to allow employers to pay them less, which is what he said and hasn't retracted. I mean, as the Leonard Cheshire Charity said, it's deeply ill-informed, it's very saddening, and it completely misses the point. And he's not just an individual, he is the Minister for Welfare Reform. His direct decisions have an impact on disabled people
in
this country.
There was Guy guidance from Labour's Department for Trade and Industry in 2003 on employment of disabled people, saying that they could be exempted from the minimum wage when they did work-related activity for therapeutic reasons. There could be deeper reasons behind this, couldn't there, Lisa?
Well, no, because what we know very strongly is the reason why 500,000 disabled people fell out of employment last year is because of attitudes towards disability. Most of those people weren't offered flexible working, they weren't offered support at work, they weren't offered temporary relief from some of their duties,
and
they weren't
offered
support from government. So we've got to change attitudes, and you don't do it with the Minister for Welfare Reform who thinks that people with disabilities aren't worth the minimum wage.
Mark, I thought you said that you thought somebody like him should go for saying that there were two different classes of people because of their disability or otherwise. You were quoted saying
that. Well, I think anybody who comes up with such a crass comment, sort of without a contextual background to it, should do. But I do think that when he first came up with this, and when Ed Miliband raised this in PMQs, I was very worried that actually he was going to try and kill off a very interesting debate. And what's been fascinating about this is there has been a very, very healthy debate about actually the issues that do face certain people who have more trouble of getting into work. And I think it's important that we don't kill off that type of debate, and we can be brave enough to have it.
Mark Garnier, Lisa Nandy, Andrew George, thanks very much indeed. Last week, Labour revealed that the Shadow Justice Minister Sadiq Khan had been given the job of winning back voters who'd transferred their support to the Green Party. It's been reported that some Liberal Democrat activists feel that their party needs to do something similar because of the fear that many of their supporters will be tempted to vote Green in key seats at the next election. In her speech to the recent conference of the Green Party of England and Wales, their leader, Natalie Bennett, named Bristol West as a seat she was confident of winning. Currently held by the Lib Dem Communities and Local Government Minister Stephen Williams, the seat is also a Labour target. John Beazley reports from Bristol West, where he's been assessing the Greens' chances.
We're walking around St Nicholas Market in the heart of Bristol. It's a market made up of lots of small independent traders, something that Bristol's very proud of.
Daniela Radici is the leader of the Green Party group on Bristol City Council. And as we talk, she explains that it's not just the shops and stalls in this famous market which are locally based, so are many of the handmade niche products on sale, and even the pounds to pay for them.
Bristol has its own currency. It's been going for nearly 2 years now. Well, 2 years, it's had its second birthday.
And what's this currency called?
It's called the Bristol Pound. And it's an economic experiment in localisation of the economy.
And if that sounds idiosyncratic, then listen to this description of one of the city's parliamentary constituencies.
It's a curiosity, really, because it shouldn't even be called Bristol West. It doesn't cover the western part of the city necessarily. It actually covers the central part of the city, which ranges from Clifton, which is the smartest, fanciest bit of Bristol, the most expensive real estate in the city and probably in the West Country, to St Paul's, Eastern, inner city, multicultural, very ethnic areas. So you've got a real range from the richest to the poorest areas of Bristol, and a real range of people, a real range of political affiliations.
That was Paul Baltrop, the BBC's West of England political editor, talking about Bristol West. The Green Party thinks that it can oust the Liberal Democrats from the parliamentary seat at the next election. In the past 2 years, they've won five council seats here and polled around a quarter of the vote. And Daniela Radici believes that people are starting to realise that her party can have an impact.
I think we've got growing political experience in this city. We've had councillors on the council since 2006, so we've actually got a fair bit of weight. And with the mayoral system, we're taking part in the mayoral cabinet. Actually, for a small group, we're punching well above our weight in the city.
So what are their chances? Well, Paul Baltrop says that over the past 20 years, the voters of Bristol West have certainly developed a taste for political promiscuity.
Bristol West, really fascinating seat that back in Blair's heyday went red with Labour. They took it off the Tories, but they only held it for 8 years. And then the Lib Dems, who've been working hard in Bristol, building their presence up, getting a foothold on the council, getting a bigger number of councillors elected progressively, finally in 2005 took Bristol West. So that was the start of the tenure of Stephen Williams. In 2010, Stephen Williams actually doubled his majority.
The Lib Dem incumbent Stephen Williams won by more than 11,000 votes in 2010. Not so long ago, that would have seemed a very healthy majority. So was he, I asked, surprised to hear the Greens were planning to target his seat in May next year?
Well, I think that's extraordinarily wishful thinking. When the Green Party lost their deposits in Bristol West at the last election, and I think virtually every election before that. They do quite well in local elections in Bristol, and have done a little bit better even recently. But the same thing happened in the last Parliament. They did well in local elections a year out from a general election. And then when people start to think about who is the best person to be a Member of Parliament, who are the best group of people to actually govern the country, and of course the Liberal Democrats have now had a role in government too, then the Green Party aren't usually seen in that light at all.
But Daniela Radici, who was elected to the City Council 18 months ago for the Greens, argues the political landscape has been changing fast.
I think it's a completely different picture this year from 5 years ago. We have done massively well. We've got a high profile across the city. We've got a really excellent candidate and we've got a lot of momentum behind us. I think people will see, actually, look what Caroline Lucas has done. One Green MP has had such an amazing effect on the politics of this country. If we had another one, if we had a Green voice for Bristol, we'd really stand out as a city.
Some commentators doubt whether the Green Party's appeal can live up to its ambitions in seats like Bristol West, but The Spectator's Isabel Hardman argues that the other parties would be wise to pay the Green Party close attention.
Well, this is the funny thing. I'm not sure the main parties really are taking the Greens as seriously as they should be yet. The Lib Dems have certainly identified the seats where the Greens are a threat, but if you talk to Lib Dems who campaign on the ground, they're very worried about a lack of messaging, a lack of narrative, a lack of strategy to counter what they call the Green siege. Part of the problem is that the Greens don't necessarily win seats, but they deprive Labour of seats and they deprived the Lib Dems of seats. So in the London local elections that we've had this May, you didn't see many Greens winning seats, but what you did see was Lib Dems who'd held seats for many years on their councils losing theirs because of this Green threat, because they were splitting the left-wing-ish vote.
But how many voters have even noticed the success of the Greens in winning council seats in Bristol? After all, two-thirds of residents often ignore council elections completely. So who did they perceive as the contenders in Bristol West?
To my mind, it's Conservatives, Labour and the Liberal Democrats. But then I guess there's also UKIP. And also I've seen a lot of stickers around the place for the Bristol anti-fascists.
Would it surprise you if I told you that the Green Party think they've got a good chance here?
Yeah, it would, yeah.
I vote for Green Party, so...
You do? Did you vote for them at the council elections?
Yes, always voted Green pretty much, apart from Lib Dems slightly before.
You voted Lib Dems slightly before? When was the last time you voted Lib Dem?
Probably a few years ago.
Do you mind me asking who you voted for last time?
I don't mind you asking, but I'm not going to say.
You're not going to say, okay, fair enough. What sort of issues are you looking at this time? What's going to sway you, if you're going to be swayed at all?
Okay, I probably won't be swayed, but I'm interested in equality and in the National Health Service and everybody getting a fair crack of the whip.
Equality and the NHS are among issues where Labour would hope to have a strong appeal. But according to Isabel Hardman, Labour is also facing an audacious challenge from the Greens for voters on the left.
The Greens have very carefully positioned themselves as much more than just an environmentalist party. They are now the only mainstream-ish anti-austerity party out there. If you see, whenever Rachel Reeves makes an announcement on welfare that's designed to make Labour look tough, Natalie Bennett is out of the blocks even before Reeves has sat down, saying this is unfair to the poor and that only the Greens would ensure a recovery that wasn't built on the backs of the poorest people. So they're pitching for those people who really don't like cuts. They may be people who themselves aren't affected by the cuts. The Lib Dems have identified them as sort of metropolitan liberals, very much like the sort of voters the Libs are after themselves.
In Bristol West, Labour will likely need to carry the votes of students, academics and other left-leaning professionals if it's to win. I asked the prospective Labour parliamentary candidate, Thangam Debonair, if she was worried that some of those votes might go instead to the Greens.
They might and they might not. When I speak to people, they're talking about big issues like jobs and the future and their education and their children's rights at work when they get a job. And they also want to know what we're going to do about environmental issues. And quite a lot of them remember that it was Ed Miliband who brought in the feed-in tariff, that it was a Labour government that brought in the Climate Change Act, that if it weren't for the Labour government, we wouldn't have had Copenhagen Summit. So people don't necessarily say because they're green in values that that means they need to vote for a party with the same name. I'm green and I'm in the Labour Party.
Even so, the BBC's regional political editor Paul Baltrop says Labour may find it rather helpful if the Green vote rises here.
Labour have made a big effort. They are focusing hard on the seat they know it's one of their targets. But, you know, they're looking at quite a mountain to climb. An 11,000 majority to overturn is very big indeed. They're probably quite relieved that the Greens are doing quite well. They hope that'll peg back the Lib Dems. But whether that'll give them enough to sneak through the middle and take the seat, hard to tell.
In the centre of Bristol, there's a clock on the handsome Georgian Corn Exchange building, which houses St Nicholas Market. The hands show not only Greenwich Mean Time, but the much older Bristol Time, used before UK clocks were standardised. At the next election, the Green Party is hoping the voters of Bristol West will help them call time on old party politics.
That was John Beasley reporting, bringing us to the end of this week's edition of the Westminster Hour. From all of us on the team, have a good evening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.